potential market for you then. Colin Holt, magician, watch out.
The Comedy Club on BBC Radio 4 Extra. Sunday to Friday nights from 10.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 4 o'clock. Hello there. I'm Joanna Pinnock with drama next by George Bernard Shaw. Stay with us for The Devil's Disciple. In the seventh dimension later comes a story of the aftermath of a disaster in space from Ray Bradbury. Kaleidoscope is at 6:30. And after that, Uncle Mort and Hello Cheeky are amongst the all-time comedy favourites of David Quantick, who is your comedy controller from 7 o'clock. Now, today's drama is a 1976 production of a play by George Bernard Shaw set during the American Revolution. It's 1777 and trouble is brewing in a corner of New Hampshire as Richard, rebellious rascal and all-round black sheep of the Dudgeon family, returns home for a reading of his father's will.
The Devil's Disciple. A melodrama by Bernard Shaw, with James Lawrenson, Lucy Fleming, Tenniel Evans, and Tony Church as General Burgoyne.
At the most wretched hour between a black night and a wintry morning in the year 1777, Mrs. Dudgeon of New Hampshire is sitting up in the kitchen and general dwelling room of her farmhouse on the outskirts of the town of Websterbridge. Mrs. Dudgeon's chair, like all the others in the room, is uncushioned and unpainted. Opposite the fireplace, between the door and the corner, a shamelessly ugly black horsehair sofa stands against the wall. A girl of 16 or 17 has fallen asleep on it. Suddenly there comes a tapping at the door. Not loud enough to wake the sleepers. Then knocking, which disturbs Mrs. Dudgeon a little. Finally the latch is tried, whereupon she springs up at once.
Well, why don't you open the door? Oh, oh, dear me, now, this is... Wake up, do you hear?
What is it?
Wake up and be ashamed of yourself, you unfeeling, sinful girl, falling asleep like that and your father hardly cold in his grave.
I didn't mean to, I dropped off.
Oh, yes, you've plenty of excuses, I dare say, dropped off. Why don't you get up and let your uncle in? After me waiting up all night for him. Oh, there. Now, oh, I'll open the door. Much good you are to wait up. Go and mend that fire a bit.
Yes.
Oh, it's you, Christy.
Oh. But it's cold. Why, who are you?
Essie.
Oh, you may well ask. Look. Go to your room, child, and lie down, since you haven't feeling enough to keep you awake. Your history isn't fit for your own ears to hear.
I was just...
Don't answer me, miss, but show your obedience by doing what I tell you. And don't forget your prayers. She'd have gone to bed last night, just as if nothing had happened if I'd let her.
Well, she can't be expected to feel Uncle Peter's death like one of the family.
What are you talking about, child? Isn't she his daughter? The punishment of his wickedness and shame?
Uncle Peter's daughter?
Why else should she be here? Do you think I've not had enough trouble and care put upon me bringing up my own girls? Let alone you and your good-for-nothing brother. Without having your uncle's bastards.
Shh, she may hear you.
Let her hear me. People who fear God don't fear to give the devil's work its right name. Well, and how long are you going to stare there like a stuck pig? What news have you for me?
The minister's to break the news to you.
Break
the news? He'll be here presently.
Break what news?
Father's dead too.
Your father?
It's not my fault. When we got to Nevinstown, we found him ill in bed. He didn't know us at first. The minister sat up with him and sent me away. He died in the night.
Well, I do think this is hard on me. It's very hard on me. His brother, that was a disgrace all his life, gets hanged on the public gallows as a rebel, and your father, instead of staying at home where his duty was with his own family, goes after him and dies, leaving everything on my shoulders. After sending this girl to me to take care of, too, it's sinful, so it is downright sinful.
I think it's going to be a fine morning after all.
A fine morning, and your father newly dead. Where's your feelings, child?
I didn't mean any harm. I suppose a man may make a remark about the weather even if his father's dead.
A nice comfort my children are to me. One son a fool and the other a lost sinner has left his home to live with smugglers and gypsies and villains, scum of the earth.
That's the minister.
Well, aren't you going to let Mr. Anderson in?
Oh. Have you told her, Christy?
She made me.
Sister? The Lord has laid his hand very heavily upon you.
It's his will, I suppose. I must bow to it. But I do think it's hard. What call of Timothy to go to Springtown to remind everyone he belonged to a man that was being hanged and that deserved it, if ever a man did.
Your eldest son was present at the execution, Mrs. Dudgeon.
Richard?
Yes.
Let it be a warning to him. He may end that way himself, the wicked, dissolute, godless. Did Timothy see him?
Yes.
Well?
He only saw him in the crowd. They did not speak. Your husband was greatly touched and impressed by his brother's awful death. Mm. Well, wasn't it only natural, Mrs. Dudgeon? He softened towards his prodigal son in that moment. He sent for him to come to see him.
Sent for Richard?
Yes, but Richard would not come. He sent his father a message, but I'm sorry to say it was a wicked message, an awful message.
What was it?
That he would stand by his wicked uncle and stand against his good parents in this world and the next.
He will be punished for it. He will be punished for it in both worlds.
Now that is not in our hands, Mrs. Dudgeon.
Did I say it was, Mr. Anderson? We are told that the wicked should be punished. Why should we do our duty and keep God's law if there's to be no difference made between us and those who follow their own likings and dislikings, and make a jest of us and of their Maker's word?
Well, Richard's earthly father has been merciful to him, and his heavenly judge is the father of us all.
Richard's earthly father was a soft-headed... Well, I am Richard's mother. If I am against him, who has any right to be for him? Won't you sit down, Mr. Anderson? I should have asked you before, but I'm so troubled.
Thank you. Has Christy told you about the new will?
The new will? Well, did Timothy...
Yes, in his last hours, he changed his mind.
And you let him rob me?
I had no power to prevent him giving what was his to his own son.
He had nothing of his own. His money was the money I brought him as my marriage portion. It was for me to deal with my own money and my own son. He dare not have done it if I'd been with him, and well he knew it. That was why he stole away like a thief, to take advantage of the law, to rob me by making a new will behind my back. The more shame on you, Mr. Anderson.
What?
You, a minister of the gospel, to act as his accomplice in such a crime.
I will take no offence at what you say in the first bitterness of your grief.
Grief?
Well, of your disappointment, if you can find it in your heart to think that the better word.
My heart? My heart? And since when have you begun to hold up our hearts as trustworthy guides for us? Don't lie, Mr. Anderson. We are told that the heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. My heart belongs not to Timothy, but to that poor wretched brother of his that has just ended his days with a rope around his neck.
What?
Aye, to Peter Dudgeon. You know it, old Eli Hawkins, a man to whose pulpit you succeeded, though you're not worthy to loose his shoe latchet, told you when he gave over our souls into your charge. He warned me and strengthened me against my heart, and made me marry a God-fearing man, as he thought. What else but that discipline has made me the woman I am? And you, you, who followed your heart in marriage, you talk to me of what I find in my heart.
No.
Go home to your pretty wife, man, and leave me to my prayers.
The Lord forbid that I should come between you and the source of all comfort.
The Lord will know what to forbid and what to allow without your help.
And whom to forgive, I hope. Eli Hawkins and myself, if we ever set up our preaching against his law. Just one word. On necessary business, Mrs. Dudgeon. There is the reading of the will to be gone through. And Richard has a right to be present. He is in the town. But he has the grace to say that he does not want to force himself in here.
He shall come here. Does he expect us to leave his father's house for his convenience? Let them all come and come quickly and go quickly. They shall not make the will an excuse to shirk half their day's work. I shall be ready, never fear.
Mrs. Dudgeon, I used to have some little influence with you. When did I lose it?
When you married for love. Now you're answered.
Yes, I'm answered.
Thief! Christy! Christy! Get up out of that and be ashamed of yourself. Sleeping and your father dead?
Well, do you suppose we're never going to sleep until we're out of mourning?
I want none of your sulks here. God help me lay this table. We shall have the minister back here with the lawyer and all the family to read the will before you've done toasting yourself. And go wake that girl. And light the stove in the shed. You can't have your breakfast here. And mind you wash yourself. Make yourself fit to receive the company. Now, mind, there are 10 biscuits there, and let there be 10 when I come back after dressing myself. And keep your fingers off the raisins in that cake. And tell Essie the same. I suppose I can trust you to bring in the case of stuffed birds without breaking the glass.
You'd better put the inkstand instead for the lawyer.
That's no answer to make me, sir. Go and do as you're told. Oh, stop. Take down that shutter before you go. Let the daylight in. Can't expect me to do all the heavy work of the house. The great lout like you idling about.
Here's the minister's wife.
What? Is she coming here?
Yeah.
What does she want troubling me at this hour before I'm properly dressed to receive people?
Better ask her.
You better keep a civil tongue in your head. Look, tell that girl to come to me as soon as she's had her breakfast. And tell her to make herself fit to be seen before the people. Nice manners, that. Come in. Oh, it's you, is it, Mrs. Anderson?
Yes. Can I do anything for you, Mrs. Dudgeon? Can I help to get the place ready before they come to read the will?
Thank you, Mrs. Anderson. My house is always ready for anyone to come into.
Yes, indeed it is. Perhaps you'd rather I didn't intrude upon you just now.
Oh, one more or less will make no difference this morning, Mrs. Anderson. Now that you're here, you'd better stay, if you wouldn't mind shutting the door.
Oh.
That's better. I must go and tidy myself a bit. I suppose you don't mind stopping here to receive anyone that comes until I'm ready.
Oh, yes, certainly. Leave that to me, Mrs. Dudgeon, and take your time.
I thought that would be more in your way than getting the house ready. Ah, there you are, Etsy. Come here and let me look at you. Oh, that's what you call doing your hair properly, I suppose. Oh. It's easy to see what you are now you were brought up. Now listen to me and do what you're told. You sit down there in the corner by the fire, and when the company comes, don't dare to speak until you're spoken to.
Mm-hmm.
Now your father's people had better see you and know that you're there. They're as much bound to keep you from starvation as I am. At any rate, they might help. But let me have no chattering. Making free with them as if you were their equal. Do you hear?
Yes.
Well, then go and do as you're told. Well, never mind her, Mrs. Anderson. You know who she is and what she is. If she gives you any trouble, just tell me and I'll settle accounts with her.
You mustn't mind if your aunt is strict with you. She's a very good woman and desires your good too.
Yes.
You are not going to be sullen, I hope, Essie.
No.
That's a good girl. Do you know any of your father's relatives?
No. They wouldn't have anything to do with him. They were too religious. Father used to talk about Dick Dudgeon, but I never saw him.
Dick Tudgeon. Essie, do you wish to be a really respectable and grateful girl and make a place for yourself here by steady good conduct?
Yes.
Then you must never mention the name of Richard Dudgeon. Never even think about him. He's a bad man.
What has he done?
You mustn't ask questions about him, Essie. You're too young to know what it is to be a bad man. Ah, they're beginning to come. Now remember your aunt's directions, Essie, and be a good girl. Good morning, Mr. Dudgeon.
Good morning.
Will you open the door, please? The people have come. She'll be here in a moment. Ask them to wait.
Our poor afflicted sister will be with us in a moment. Are we all here?
All except Dick.
Well, I hope he will have the grace not to come. I hope so.
Yeah. Friends, Mrs. Dodge.
Would it comfort your sister if we were to offer up a prayer?
Or sing a hymn?
I have been with our sister this morning already, friends. In our hearts, we ask a blessing.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
Essie, did you say amen?
No.
Then say it, like a good girl.
Amen.
That's right, that's right. We know who you are, but we are willing to be kind to you if you're a good girl and deserve it. We are all equal before the throne.
Here's Dick.
Ladies and gentlemen, your servant, your very humble servant. Oh, how happy you all look. How glad to see me. Oh, Mother, keeping up appearances as usual. That's right, that's right. Uncle William. Now, I haven't seen you since you gave up drinking.
What?
Well, you have given it up, haven't you? Of course you have. Quite right, too. You overdid it. Now, where's that upright horse dealer, Uncle Titus? Uncle Titus, come forth. As usual, with the ladies.
Be ashamed of yourself, sir.
Oh, I am. But I'm proud of my uncle, proud of all my relatives. Now, who could look at them and not be proud and joyful? Mr. Anderson. He's still at the good work, still shepherding them. Keep them up to the mark, Minister. Keep them up to the mark. Come, clink a glass with me, Pastor, for the sake of old times.
You know, I think, Mr. Dudgeon, that I do not drink before dinner.
You will someday, Pastor. Uncle William used to drink before breakfast.
I did not.
Oh, come, it will give your sermons unction. Oh, but do not begin on my mother's company sherry. I stole some when I was 6 years old, and I've been a temperate man ever since. So I hear you're married, Pastor, and that your wife has a most ungodly allowance of good looks.
Sir, you are in the presence of my wife.
Oh, your servant, madam. No offence. Well, you deserve your reputation. But I'm sorry to see by your expression that you're a good woman. Sir. All the same, Pastor, I respect you more than I did before. By the way, did I hear or did I not that our late lamented Uncle Peter, though unmarried, was a father?
He had only one irregular child.
Only one? Why, he thinks one a mere trifle. I blush for you, Uncle Titus.
Mr. Dudgeon, you are in the presence of your mother and her grief.
It touches me profoundly, Pastor. By the way, what has become of the irregular child?
There, sir, listening to you.
What? Why the devil didn't you tell me that before? Children suffer enough in this house with a... Oh, come, little cousin, never mind me. It was not meant to hurt you. Oh. Who's been making her cry? Who's been ill-treating her? By God,
silence your blasphemous tongue. I will bear no more of this. Leave my house.
How do you know it's your house until the will is read? Ladies and gentlemen, as the eldest son of my late father and the unworthy head of this household, I bid you welcome. And by your leave, Minister Anderson, by your leave, Lawyer Hawkins... Head of the table for the head of the family. Ah, we meet on a melancholy occasion. A father dead, an uncle actually hanged and probably damned. That's right, you pull your longest faces. Provided only there's hope in the eyes of the child. Oh, now then, Lawyer Hawkins, business, business, get on with the will, man.
Do not let yourself be ordered or hurried, Mr. Hawkins.
Well, Mr. Dudgeon means no offence, I feel sure. I'll not keep you a second, Mr. Dudgeon, just while I get my glasses.
They notice your civility, Mr. Hawkins. They're prepared for the worst. A glass of wine to clear your voice before you begin.
Thank you, Mr. Dudgeon. Your good health, sir.
Yours, sir.
Now,
will anyone oblige me with a glass of water?
I will.
The will is not exactly in proper legal phraseology.
No, my father died without the consolations of the law.
Good again, Mr. Dudgeon. Good again. Are you ready, sir?
Ready, aye, ready. For what we're about to receive, may the Lord make us truly thankful. Go ahead.
This is the last will and testament of me, Timothy Dudgeon, on my deathbed at Nevinston on the road from Springtown to Westerbridge, on this 24th day of September, 1777. I hereby revoke all former wills made by me and declare that I am of sound mind and know well what I'm doing, and that this is my real will according to my own wish and affections. Oh, it's bad phraseology. Wrong phraseology. I give and bequeath £100 to my younger son, Christopher Dudgeon, £50 to be paid to him on the day of his marriage to Sarah Wilkins, if she'll have him, and £10 on the birth of each of his children, up to the number of five.
How if she won't have him?
She will if I have £50.
That's good, my brother. Proceed.
I give and bequeath to my wife, Annie Dudgeon, born Annie Primrose. You see, he didn't know the law, Mr. Dudgeon. Your mother was not born Annie. She was christened so. An annuity of £52 a year for life, to be paid out of the interest of her own money. There's a way to put it, Mr. Dudgeon. Her own money.
A very good way to put God's truth. It was every penny my own. £52 a year.
And I recommend her for her goodness and piety to the forgiving care of her children, having stood between them and her as far as I could to the best of my ability.
And this is my reward. You know what I think, Mr. Anderson. You know the word I gave for it.
It cannot be helped, Mrs. Dudgeon. We must take what comes to us. Go on, sir.
I give and bequeath my house at Westerbridge, with the land belonging to it and all the rest of my property so ever, to my eldest son and heir, Richard Dudgeon.
Oh, the fatted calf, Minister, the fatted calf.
On these conditions.
The devil are the conditions?
To wit, first, that he shall not let my brother Peter's natural child starve or be driven by want to an evil life.
Agreed.
Second, that he shall be a good friend to my old horse, Jim. He should have written James, sir.
James shall live in clover. Go on.
And keep my deaf farm labourer, Proger Feston, in his service.
Proger shall get drunk every Sunday.
Third, that he make Christie a present on his marriage out of the ornaments in the best room.
There you are, Christie. The stuffed birds.
I'd rather have the china peacocks.
You shall have both. Oh. Go on.
Fourthly and lastly, that he try to live at peace with his mother as far as she will consent to it.
Anything more, Mr. Hawkins?
Finally, I give and bequeath my soul into my Maker's hands, humbly asking forgiveness for all my sins and mistakes, and hoping that he will so guide my son that it may not be said that I have done wrong in trusting to him rather than to others in the perplexity of my last hour in this strange place.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
My mother does not say amen.
Mr. Hawkins, is that a proper will? Remember, I have his rightful legal will drawn up by yourself, leaving all to me.
This is a very wrongly and irregularly worded will, Mrs. Dudgeon, though it contains, in my judgment, an excellent disposal of his property.
That is not what you were asked, Mr. Hawkins. Is it a legal will?
The courts will sustain it against the other.
But why, if the other is more lawfully worded?
Because, sir, the courts will sustain the claim of a man, and that man the eldest son, against any woman, if they can.
Oh.
I warned you, Mrs. Dudgeon, when you got me to draw that other will, that it was not a wise will, and that though you might make him sign it, he would never be easy until he revoked it. But you wouldn't take advice, and now Mr. Richard is cock of the walk.
Where have you been, Essie? How dare you go out by yourself after the orders I gave you?
He asked for a drink. Who asked for a drink?
What? I?
Oh, Essie. Essie.
I believe I did. What? Afraid of me?
No, no, I'm not.
Oh, you've been up the street to the Market Gate Spring to get that. It's delicious. Thank you. What do they call you? Bessie?
Essie.
Essie, to be sure. Are you a good girl, Essie?
Yes. Well, I think so. I mean, I hope so.
Essie, did you ever hear of a person called a devil?
Shame on you, sir, with a mere child.
Oh, by your leave, Minister, I do not interfere with your sermons. Do not you interrupt mine. Do you know what they call me, Essie?
Dick?
Yes, Dick, but something else too. They call me the devil's disciple.
Why do you let them?
Well, because it's true. I was brought up in the other service, but I knew from the first that the devil was my natural master and captain and friend. I saw that he was in the right and that the world cringed to his conqueror only through fear. I prayed secretly to him, and he comforted me and saved me from having my spirit broken in this house of children's tears. I promised him my soul and swore an oath that I would stand up for him in this world and stand by him in the next. Now, that promise and that oath made a man of me. From this day, this house is his home.
Mr. Dudgeon.
And no child shall cry in it. Now, this hearth is his altar. And no soul shall ever cower over it in the dark evenings and be afraid. Now, which of you good men will take this child and rescue her from the house of the devil?
I will. You should be burnt alive.
But I don't want to.
Actually doesn't want to. Most virtuous lady.
Have a care, Richard Dudgeon, the Lord...
Oh, have a care, you, Uncle Titus. In an hour from this, there will be no law here but martial law.
What?
I passed the soldiers within 6 miles on my way here. Before noon, Major Swindon's gallows for rebels will be up in the marketplace.
What have we to fear from that, sir?
Oh, more than you think, Mr. Anderson. He hanged the wrong man at Springtown. He thought Uncle Peter was respectable because the Dudgeons had a good name. But his next example would be the best man in the town to whom he can bring home a rebellious word. Well, we're all rebels, and you know it.
Yes,
you are. You haven't damned King George up hill and down dale as I have, but you've prayed for his defeat. And you, Anthony Anderson, have conducted the service and sold your family Bible to buy a pair of pistols. Now, they mayn't hang me, perhaps, because the moral effect of the devil's disciple dancing on nothing wouldn't help them. But a minister,
no.
Or a lawyer, or an upright horse dealer, or a reformed drunkard.
What, I?
Oh, eh?
No.
Would that show that King George meant business, huh?
Come, my dear. He's only trying to frighten you. There's no danger.
Now then, how many of you will stay with me? Run up the American flag on the devil's house and make a fight for freedom. Long live the devil. What, mother, are you off too?
My curse on you, my dying curse.
It will bring me luck.
Mayn't I stay?
What? Have they forgotten to save your soul and their anxiety about their own bodies? Oh, yes, you may stay. You may stay. Tears. The devil's baptism. Oh, yes. You may cry that way, Essie, if you like.
Minister Anderson's house is in the main street of Webster Bridge, not far from the town hall. The evening has closed in, and the chief dwelling room is dark except for the cosy firelight and the dim oil lamp seen through the window in the wet street, where there is a quiet, steady, warm, windless downpour of rain. As the town clock strikes the quarter, Judith comes in with a couple of candles in earthenware candlesticks and sets them on the table.
Here you are at last.
Take care, my love. I'm wet. Wait till I get my cloak off. Now. Now, I'm not late, am I? The town clock struck the quarter as I came in at the front door, and the town clock is always fast.
I'm sure it's slow this evening. I'm so glad you're back.
Anxious, my dear?
A little.
Why, you've been crying.
Only a little. Never mind. It's all over now. Oh, what's that?
It's only King George, my dear. He's returning to barracks or having his roll called or getting ready for tea or booting or saddling or something. Soldiers don't ring the bell or call over the banisters when they want anything. They send a boy out with a bugle to disturb the whole town.
Do you think there is really any danger?
Not the least in the world.
Oh, you say that to comfort me, not because you believe it. My heart shrinks every time I think of the soldiers.
Never mind that, dear. Bravery is none the worse for costing a little pain.
Yes, I suppose so. Oh, how brave you are, my dear. Well, I shall be brave too. You shan't be ashamed of your wife.
That's right. Now you make me happy. Well. Oh, I called on Richard Dudgeon on my way back, but he wasn't in.
You called on that man?
No, nothing happened, dearie. He was out.
But why did you go there?
Well, it's all the talk that Major Swindon is going to do what he did in Springtown, make an example of some notorious rebel, as he calls us. He pounced on Peter Dudgeon as the worst character there, and it's the general belief that he will pounce on Richard as the worst here.
But Richard said...
Pooh, Richard said. I left a message for him.
What message?
Only that I should be glad to see him for a moment on a matter of importance to himself, and that if he would look in here when he was passing, he would be welcome.
You asked that man to come here?
I did.
Oh, I hope he won't come. I pray that he may not come.
Why? Don't you want him to be warned?
Well, he must know of his danger. Oh, Tony, is it wrong to hate a blasphemer and a villain? I do hate him. I can't get him out of my mind. I know he will bring harm with him. He insulted you. He insulted me. He insulted his mother.
Well, dear, let's forgive him and then it won't matter.
I know it's wrong to hate anybody.
Come, dear, you're not so wicked as you think. The worst sin towards our fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent to them. That's the essence of inhumanity. After all, my dear, if you watch people carefully, you'll be surprised to find how like hate is to love.
No.
Depend on it, my dear, you're really fonder of Richard than you are of me, if you only knew it, eh?
Oh, don't say that. Don't say that, Tony, even in jest. You don't know what a horrible feeling it gives me.
Well, never mind, pet. He's a bad man and you hate him as he deserves. And you're going to make the tea, aren't you?
Oh, yes, I forgot. I've been keeping you waiting all this time.
Oh, have you stitched up the shoulder of my old coat?
Yes, dear.
Well, did anyone call when I was out?
No, only... Oh, who's that?
It's all right, pet, it's all right. He won't eat you, whoever he is. Ah, you might have raised the latch. Come in, Mr. Dudgeon. Nobody stands on much ceremony with us. Come in. It's still raining.
It's raining like the very... I beg your pardon, madam, but my coat is wet.
Take it off, sir, and let it hang before the fire a while. My wife will excuse your shirt sleeves.
Oh.
Judith, put in another spoonful of tea for Mr. Dudgeon.
The magic of property, Pastor. Are even you civil to me now that I've succeeded to my father's estate?
Oh.
Let me take your coat. And I think, sir, that since you accept my hospitality, you cannot have so bad an opinion of it.
Oh, I come, sir, on your own invitation. You left word you had something important to tell me.
I have a warning, which it is my duty to give you.
Oh, you want to preach to me. Excuse me, I prefer a walk in the rain.
Without your coat? Oh, don't be alarmed, sir. I'm no great preacher. You're quite safe. Mr. Dudgeon, you are in danger in this town.
What danger?
Your uncle's danger. Major Swindon's gallows.
It is you who are in danger. I warned you before.
Yes, Mr. Dudgeon, but they do not think so in the town. And even if I were in danger, I have duties here which I must not forsake. But you are a free man. Why should you run any risk?
Do you think I should be any great loss, Minister?
Well, I think a man's life is worth saving, whoever it belongs to.
Thank you.
Come, you'll have a cup of tea to prevent you catching cold.
I observe that Mrs. Anderson is not quite so pressing as you are, Pastor.
You are welcome for my husband's sake.
I know I'm not welcome for my own, madam. But I think I will not break bread here, Minister.
Oh, give me a good reason for that.
Because there is something in you that I respect, and that makes me desire to have you for my enemy.
Oh, that's well said. On those terms, sir, I will accept your enmity, or any man's. Judith, Mr. Dudgeon will stay to tea.
Oh.
Sit down. It'll take a few minutes to draw by the fire.
Thank you.
Well, I mustn't tell you, I see. But it was nothing that need leave us worse friend. Enemies, I mean. Judith is a great enemy of yours.
If all my enemies were like Mrs. Anderson, I should be the best Christian in America.
Ah, you hear that, Judith? Mr. Dudgeon knows how to turn a compliment.
Who is that?
Ah, Christy.
Oh, are you here?
Yes. Oh, be gone, you fool. Mrs. Anderson doesn't want the whole family to tea at once.
Mother's very ill.
Well, she wants to see me?
No.
I thought not.
She wants to see the minister at once.
Ah. Oh, not before you've had some tea.
I shall enjoy it more when I come back, dear.
The rain's over.
Where is your mother, Christy?
At Uncle Titus's.
Have you fetched the doctor?
No. She didn't tell me to.
Well, go on there at once. I'll overtake you on your uncle's doorstep. Wait a moment, Christy.
Hmm?
Your brother must be anxious to know the particulars.
Oh, not I. He doesn't know, and I don't care. Be off with you, you oaf. We shall know soon enough.
Well... Perhaps you let me bring you the news myself. Judith, will you give Mr. Dudgeon his tea and keep him here until I return?
Must I?
My dear, I can depend on you.
Yes.
You will not mind two old people like us, Mr. Dudgeon. I shall not say good evening. You will be here when I come back.
Ah, Mrs. Anderson, I am perfectly aware of the nature of your sentiments toward me. I shall not intrude on you. Good evening.
Oh, no, no, don't go. Please don't go.
Why? You don't want me here?
Oh, yes, I... If I tell you the truth, you'll use it to torment me.
Torment? What right have you to say that, huh? Do you expect me to stay after that?
I want you to stay, but it's not because I like you.
Indeed?
Yes, I'd rather you did go than mistake me about that. I hate and dread you, and my husband knows it. If you're not here when he comes back, he'll believe that I disobeyed him and drove you away.
Whereas, of course, you've really been so kind and hospitable and charming to me that I only want to go away out of mere contrariness, eh?
Oh!
Oh, stop, 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 I tell you, don't do that! Oh. Oh. He wrung my heart by being a man. Need you tear it by being a woman? Oh. Has he not raised you above my insults like himself? Oh, there. That's right. You're better now, aren't you?
Yes.
Ah, that's better. You're yourself again. Well, so's Richard. Well, shall we go to tea like a quiet, respectable couple and wait your husband's return?
If you please. I'm sorry to have been so foolish.
Oh, I'm sorry for your sake that I am what I am. Allow me.
Will you sit down?
Thank you.
Do you take sugar?
No, but plenty of milk. Let me give you some toast.
Thank you. Won't you help yourself?
Thanks.
Why do you laugh?
I was thinking that if any stranger came in here now, he'd take us for man and wife.
You mean, I suppose, that you are more my age than he is?
I never thought such a thing. I see there is another side to domestic joy.
Yeah, I'd rather have a husband whom everybody respects than
the devil's disciple. Yeah. Oh, you're right, but I dare say your love helps him to be a good man, just as your hate helps me to be a bad one.
My husband has been very good to you. He has forgiven you for insulting him and is trying to save you. Can you not forgive him for being so much better than you are? How dare you belittle him by putting yourself in his place?
Did I?
Yes, you did. You said that if anybody came in, they would take us for man and... The English soldiers. What are they?
Oh! What you four outside, you two for me. Oh.
You two men stand there.
No,
sorry. Sorry to disturb you, ma'am. Duty. Anthony Anderson, I arrest you in King George's name as a rebel.
But that's not...
Sergeant...
Come, Parson, put your coat on and come along.
Yes. I'll come.
But
my coat, my Parson's coat.
You
did you ever arrest a man of my cloth before, Sergeant?
Well, no, sir. At least only an army chaplain. I'm sorry, sir, but duty demands...
Oh, just so, Sergeant. Well, I'm not ashamed of handcuffs. Thank you kindly for the apology.
One gentleman to another, sir. Would you like to say a word to your missus, sir, before you go?
We shall meet again before...
Yeah, of course, of course.
Well,
it's no call for the lady to distress herself. Still, your last chance, sir.
My love, this gallant gentleman is good enough to allow us a moment of leave-taking. He's trying to spare you the truth, but you'd better know. Are you listening to me? Do you understand that I am going to my death? And remember, you must now find our friend who was with us just now. Do you understand?
Yes.
See that you get him safely out of harm's way. Don't fear life. Let him know of my danger. But if he finds out, tell him that he cannot save me. They would hang him and they would not spare me. And tell him that I am steadfast in my religion as he is in his. And that he may depend on me to the death.
Oh.
And now, my dear, I'm afraid the sergeant will not believe that you love me like a wife unless you give me one kiss before I go.
Oh, I ought to tell... It's murder.
No, only a kiss. For his sake.
I can't. You must...
Oh, my poor girl.
Oh. Oh.
Now, sergeant, quick, before she comes to, the handcuffs.
Oh, never mind, sir, I'll trust you. You're a game one. You would have been a soldier, sir. You two get fell in. Between them two, please.
Goodbye, wife. Goodbye home. Muffle the drums and quick march.
No light? What on earth? Judith? Judith? Judith!
Yes. Did you call? What's the matter?
I just come in and found you lying here, with the candles burnt out and the tea poured out and cold. What has happened?
I don't know. Have I been asleep, I suppose? I don't know.
Heaven forgive me, I left you alone with that scoundrel.
Oh.
Oh, my poor pet.
Oh, what shall I do? Oh, my God, what shall I do?
Now, never mind, never mind, my dearest dear. It was my fault. Come, you're safe now. You're not hurt, are you?
No.
There, that's right, that's right. If only you're not hurt, nothing else matters.
Tony?
Yes, dear?
Do you think we're only in a dream now?
Perhaps so, pet. But you may as well dream a cup of tea when you're about it.
Oh, stop, stop. You don't know.
Oh, dear, what is it? I can't bear it any longer. You must tell me. Oh, it was all my fault. I was mad to trust him.
No, don't say that. You mustn't say that. He... Oh, no, no, I can't. Tony.
What?
Don't speak to me. Take my hands. Both my hands. Make me think of you, not of him. There's danger. There's frightful danger. But it's your danger, and I can't keep thinking of it. I can't. My mind keeps going back to his danger. He must be saved. No! No, you must be saved. You. Oh, heaven help me.
Now, calmly, my pet. You're quite distracted.
Yeah, I may well be. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. He must be saved.
What?
Oh, Essie, what do you want?
I was to come to you.
Who told you to?
Are you here?
Of course. Don't be foolish, child.
Now, gently, dearest. You'll frighten her. Come here, Essie. Now, who sent you?
Dick.
Dick?
He sent me word by a soldier. I was to come here at once and do whatever Mrs. Anderson told me.
A soldier? Oh, I see it all now. They've arrested Richard.
No. I asked the soldier, Dick's safe. But the soldier said you had been taken.
It's all right, dear. I understand. Thank you, Essie, for coming, but you may go home now. I don't need you now.
Are you sure Dick's not been touched? Perhaps he told the soldier to say it was the minister. Mrs. Anderson, do you think it can have been that?
Now, tell her the truth if it is so, Judith. She will learn it from the first neighbour she meets in the street.
Oh, but what will they do to him? Will they hang him?
Oh, I hope not, Essie, I hope not. Now, perhaps if you're very quiet and patient, we may be able to help him in some way.
Yes, help him. Yes. I'll be good.
I must go to him at once, Judith.
No. I'll be good.
You must go away, far away to some place of safety.
Oh, pooh.
Do you want to kill me? Do you think I can bear to live for days and days with every knock at the door, every footstep giving me a spasm of terror? To lie awake for nights and nights in an agony of dread, listening for them to come and arrest you?
Do you think it would be better to know that I had run away from my post at the first sign of danger?
Oh, you won't go, I know it. You'll stay and I shall go mad.
My dear, your duty is...
What do I care about my duty?
Judith!
I'm doing my duty. I'm clinging to my duty. My duty is to get you away, to save you, to leave him to his fate. My instinct is the same as hers, to save him above all things. Though it would be so much better for him to die, so much greater. But I know you will take your own way as he took it. Oh, I have no power, I am only a woman. I can do nothing but sit here and suffer. Only tell him I tried to save you, that I did my best to save you.
Yeah, I'm afraid he'll be thinking more of his own danger than of mine.
Oh, stop! Or I shall hate you.
Now, come. How am I to leave you if you talk like this? Quite out of your senses. Now, Essie.
Yes.
Now, just wait outside a moment like a good girl. Mrs. Anderson is not well. Now, never fear. I'll come to you presently and I'll go to Dick.
You're sure you'll go to him? You won't let her prevent you.
No. It's all right. Now, there's a good girl.
Oh. You are going to your death?
Then I shall go in my best coat, dear. Now, where... My dear, it seems that he's gone in my best coat.
Yes.
Did the soldiers make a mistake?
Yes, they made a mistake.
Oh, he might have told them. Oh, poor fellow, he was too upset, I suppose.
Yes, he might have told them. So might I.
Well, it's all very puzzling. It's almost funny. It's curious how these little things strike one, even in the most... I'd better take him his own coat. I know what he'll say. Anxious about my soul, Pastor, and also about your best coat.
Oh.
Eh? I wish I knew what has frightened you so. Was there a struggle? Did he fight?
No, he smiled.
Did he realise his danger, do you think?
He realised yours.
Mine?
He said, see that you get him safely out of harm's way. I promised. I can't keep my promise. He said, don't for your life let him know of my danger. I've told you of it. He said that if you found it out, you couldn't save him, that they will hang him and not spare you.
And you think I will let a man with that much good in him die like a dog, when a few words might make him die like a Christian? I'm ashamed of you, Judith.
He will be steadfast in his religion as you are in yours, and you may depend upon him to the death. He said so.
God forgive him. What else did he say?
He said goodbye.
Poor fellow. Poor fellow. You said goodbye to him in all kindness and charity, Judith, I hope.
I kissed him.
What? Judith?
Are you angry?
No, no, no. You were right. You were right. Oh, the poor fellow. The poor fellow. To be hanged like that at his age. Did they take him away?
Well, then you were here. That's the next thing I remember. I suppose I fainted. Now, bid me goodbye, Tony. Perhaps I shall faint again. I wish I could die.
No, no, my dear. You must pull yourself together and be sensible. I am in no danger, not the least in the world.
You're going to your death, Tony. Your sure death, if God will let innocent men be murdered. They'll not let you see him. They'll arrest you the moment you give your name. It was for you the soldiers came.
For me?
He took your place. He's dying to save you. That is why he went in your coat. That is why I kissed him.
Blood and wounds. Here, Essie, Essie.
Yes.
Off with you as hard as you can run to the inn.
Yes.
Tell them to saddle the fastest and strongest horse they have.
What? Yes.
The chestnut mare, if she's fresh, without a moment's delay. Go into the stable yard and tell the black man there that I'll give him a silver dollar if the horse is waiting for me when I come, and that I'm close on your heels. Now, away with you.
Yes.
Now, where are my boots?
You're not going to him.
Going to him? What good would that do? I'll go to them, so I will. Get me the pistols. Oh, yes, I want them. And money. Money. I want money. All the money in the house. Oh, great satisfaction it would be to him to have my company on the gallows.
You're deserting
him,
then?
Hold your tongue, woman, and get the pistols. If they took him for me in my coat, perhaps they'll take me for him in his. Do I look like him?
Horribly unlike him.
Oh, we shall see.
Is it of any use to pray now, do you think?
Pray?
Tony?
Can we pray Swindon's rope off Richard's neck?
God may soften Major Swindon's heart.
Let him then. I'm not God. I must go to work another way.
Oh.
There. Keep that. I've taken $25.
Have you forgotten even that you're a minister?
Minister, my hat. Where's my hat? Now listen, you. If you can get a word with him by pretending you're his wife, tell him to hold his tongue until morning. That will give me all the start I need.
You may depend on him to the death.
You're a fool. A fool, Judith. You don't know the man you're married to. Well, is the horse ready?
It will be ready when you come.
Good.
Won't you say goodbye?
Waste another half minute.
Oh, has he gone to save Richard? He has, hasn't he?
To save Richard? No. Richard has saved him. He's gone to save himself. Richard must die.
Next morning, the sergeant at the British headquarters in the town hall unlocks the door of a little panelled waiting room and invites Judith to enter. Being a fine figure of a man, vain of his uniform and of his rank, he feels specially qualified in a respectful way to console her.
You can have a quiet word with him here, ma'am.
Shall I have long to wait?
No, ma'am, not a minute. We kept him in the bridal for the night. He's just been brought over here for the court-martial. And don't fret, ma'am. He slept like a child and has made a rare good breakfast.
He's in good spirits.
Oh, tip-top, ma'am. The chaplain looked in to see him last night and he won 17 shillings off him at Spoil 5. He's spending among us like the gentleman he is. Duty's duty, ma'am, of course, but you're among friends here. Ah, there. I think he's coming. Your good lady, sir.
What? My wife, my adored one. How long do you allow a broken-hearted husband for leave-taking, Sergeant?
Oh, as long as we can, sir. We shall not disturb you till the court sits.
Oh, but it has struck the hour.
So it has, sir. But there's a delay. General Burgoyne's just arrived. Gentlemanly Johnny, we call him, sir. And he won't have done finding fault with everything this side of half past. I know him, sir. I served with him in Portugal. You can count on 20 minutes, sir. And by your leave, I wouldn't waste any more of them.
Sergeant.
How are you two?
Mrs. Anderson, this visit is very kind of you. How are you after last night?
Oh.
I had to leave before you recovered, but I sent word to Essie to go and look after you. She did understand the message.
Don't think about me. I haven't come here to talk about myself. Are they going to...
Well, at noon, punctually. At least, that was when they disposed of Uncle Peter.
Oh.
Is your husband safe? Is he on the wing?
He is no longer my husband.
Eh?
I disobeyed you. I told him everything. I expected him to come here and save you. I wanted him to come here and save you. He ran away instead.
Oh, that's what I meant him to do. What good would his staying have done? They'd only have hanged us both.
Richard Dudgeon, on your honour, what would you have done in his place?
Exactly what he has done, of course.
Oh, why will you not be simple with me, honest and straightforward? If you're so selfish as that, why did you let them take you last night?
Upon my life, Mrs. Anderson, I don't know. I've been asking myself that question ever since, and I can find no manner of reason for acting as I did.
You know you did it for his sake, believing he was a more worthy man than yourself.
Oh, no, that's a very pretty reason, I must say, but I'm not so modest as that. No, it wasn't for his sake.
Was it for my sake?
Well, you had a hand in it. Must have been little for your sake. You let them take me, at all events.
Oh, do you think I've not been telling myself that all night? Your death will be at my door. If I could save you as you did him, I would do it, no matter how cruel the death was.
I'm very sure I wouldn't let you.
Don't you see that I can save you?
How? By changing clothes with me, eh?
Don't. No, by telling the court who you really are.
It's no use. They wouldn't spare me, and it would spoil half his chance of escaping. They are determined to cow us by making an example of somebody on that gallows today.
Oh.
Well, let us cow them by showing that we can stand by one another to the death. That is the only force that can send Burgoyne back across the Atlantic and make America a nation.
Oh, what does all that matter?
True. What does it matter? What does anything matter? You see, men have these strange notions, Mrs. Anderson, and women see through the folly of them.
Women have to lose those they love through them.
Oh, they can easily get fresh lovers.
Oh, do you realize that you're going to kill yourself?
The only man I have any right to kill, Mrs. Anderson.
Oh.
Don't be concerned. No woman will lose her lover through my death. Bless you, nobody cares for me. Have you heard that my mother is dead?
Dead?
Of heart disease in the night. Her last word to me was her curse. I don't think I could have borne her blessing. My other relatives will not grieve much on my account. Essie will cry for a day or two, but I've provided for her. I made my own will last night.
And I?
You?
Yes, I. Am I not to care at all?
Not a scrap. Oh, you expressed your feelings towards me very frankly yesterday. What happened may have softened you for the moment, but believe me, Mrs. Anderson, you don't like a bone in my skin or a hair on my head.
Oh.
I shall be as good a riddance at 12 today as I should have been at 12 yesterday.
What can I do to show you that you're mistaken?
Don't trouble. I'll give you credit for liking me a little better than you did. All I say is that my death will not break your heart.
How do you know?
Mrs. Anderson... Excuse me, they'll be here for me presently. It is too late.
It is not too late. Call me as a witness. They'll never kill you when they know how heroically you have acted.
Oh, indeed, but if I don't go through with it, where will the heroism be? I shall simply have tricked them and they'll hang me for that like a dog. Serve me right, too.
Oh, I believe that you want to die.
No, I don't.
Then why not try to save yourself? I implore you. Listen. You said just now that you saved him for my sake. Yes, a little for my sake. Well, save yourself for my sake, and I will go with you to the end of the world.
Judith.
Yes?
If I said, to please you, that I did what I did ever so little for your sake, I lied, as men always lie to women. I should have done the same for any other man in town or any other man's wife. Now, do you understand that?
Yes. You mean that you do not love me?
Is that all it means to you?
What more? What worse can it mean to me? Oh, well, one moment more. I pray to you.
Come in.
Time's up, sir.
Quite ready now, Sergeant. Now, my dear.
Only one thing more, I entreat. I implore you, let me be present in the court. I've seen Major Swindon. He said I should be allowed if you asked it. You will ask it. It is my last request. I shall never ask you anything again. I beg and pray it of you.
If I do, will you be silent?
Yes.
You will keep faith.
I will keep faith. Oh.
Just her other arm, Sergeant.
Where is it?
Meanwhile, the council chamber is ready for the court-martial. It is a large, lofty room with a chair of state in the middle, under a tall canopy with a gilt crown and maroon curtains with the royal monogram GR. In front of the chair is a table, also draped in maroon, with a bell, a heavy inkstand and writing materials on it. Several chairs are set at the table. Major Swindon, a pale, sandy-haired, very conscientious-looking man of about 45, sits at the end of the table with his back to the door, writing. He is alone until the sergeant announces the general, in a subdued manner which suggests that gentlemanly Johnny has been making his presence felt rather heavily.
The general, sir.
General Burgoyne is 55 and very well preserved. He is a man of fashion, gallant enough to have made a distinguished marriage by an elopement, witty enough to write successful comedies, aristocratically connected enough to have had opportunities of high military distinction. His eyes, large, brilliant, apprehensive and intelligent, are his most remarkable feature. Without them, his fine nose and small mouth would suggest rather more fastidiousness and less force than go to the making of a first-rate general.
Major Swindon, I presume.
Yes, General Burgoyne, if I mistake not. I am glad to have the support of your presence this morning. It is not particularly lively business hanging this poor devil of a minister.
No, sir, it is not. It is making too much of the fellow to execute him. What more could you have done if you'd been a member of the Church of England? Martyrdom, sir, is what these people like. It is the only way in which a man can become famous without ability. However, you have committed us to hanging him, and the sooner he is hanged, the better.
We have arranged it for 12 o'clock. Nothing remains to be done except to try him.
Nothing except to save your own necks, perhaps. Have you heard the news from Springtown?
Nothing special. The latest reports are satisfactory.
Satisfactory, sir? Satisfactory. I'm glad you take that view of them.
Do I understand that in your opinion...
I do not express my opinion. I never stoop to that habit of profane language which unfortunately coarsens our profession. If I did, sir, perhaps I should be able to express my opinion of the news from Springtown. The news which you have apparently not heard. How soon do you get news from your supports here? In the course of a month, eh?
I suppose the reports have been taken to you, sir, instead of to me. Is there anything serious?
Springtown's in the hands of the rebels.
Since yesterday?
Since 2 o'clock this morning. Perhaps we shall be in their hands before 2 o'clock tomorrow morning. Have you thought of that?
As to that, General, the British soldier will give a good account of himself.
And therefore, I suppose, sir, the British officer need not know his business. The British soldier will get him out of all his blunders with the bayonet. In future, sir, I must ask you to be a little less generous with the blood of your men and a little more generous with your own brain.
I am sorry I cannot pretend to your intellectual eminence, sir. I can only do my best and rely on the devotion of my countrymen.
May I ask, are you writing a melodrama, Major Swindon?
No, sir.
What a pity. What a pity.
Do you at all realize, sir, that we have nothing standing between us and destruction but our own bluff and the sheepishness of these colonists? They are men of the same English stock as ourselves. 6-1 of us. 6-1 of us, sir. And nearly half our troops are Hessians, Brunswickers, German dragoons, and Indians with scalping knives. These are the countrymen on whose devotion you rely. Suppose the colonists find a leader. Suppose the news from Springtown should turn out to mean that they have already found a leader. What shall we do then, eh?
Our duty, sir, I presume.
Oh, quite so, quite so. Thank you, Major Swindon, thank you. Now you've settled the question, sir, thrown a flood of light on the situation. What a comfort to me to feel that I have at my side so devoted and able an officer to support me in this emergency. I think, sir, it will probably relieve both our feelings if we proceed to hang this dissenter without further delay. Especially as I am debarred by my principles from the customary military vent for my feelings.
Sir.
Bring your man in.
Yes, sir.
And mention to any officer you may meet that the court cannot wait any longer for him.
Sir.
The staff is perfectly ready, sir. They have been waiting your convenience for fully half an hour. Perfectly ready, sir.
And so am I.
Come in, gentlemen.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. Sorry to disturb you, I'm sure. Very good of you to spare us a few moments.
Will you preside, sir?
Oh, no, sir. I feel my own deficiencies too keenly to presume so far. If you will allow me, I will sit at the feet of Gamaliel.
As you please, sir. I am only trying to do my duty under excessively trying circumstances. Bring in the prisoner.
Who is that woman?
Prisoner's wife, sir.
She begged me to allow her to be present, and I thought...
You thought it would be a pleasure for her. Quite so, quite so. Give the lady a chair and make her thoroughly comfortable.
Thank you, sir.
Your name, sir?
Oh, come, you don't mean to say that you brought me here without knowing who I am.
As a matter of form, sir, give your name.
As a matter of form, then, my name is Anthony Anderson, Presbyterian minister in this town.
Indeed. Pray, Mr. Anderson, what do you gentlemen believe?
Well, I shall be happy to explain, if time is allowed me. I cannot undertake to complete your conversion in less than a fortnight.
We are not here to discuss your views.
I stand rebuked.
Oh, not you. I...
Don't mention it. Any political views, Mr. Anderson?
I understand that that is just what we're here to find out.
Do you mean to deny that you are a rebel?
I'm an American, sir.
Well, what do you expect me to think of that speech, Mr. Anderson?
I never expect a soldier to think, sir.
I advise you not to be insolent, prisoner.
You can't help yourself, General. When you make up your mind to hang a man, you put yourself at a disadvantage with him. Why should I be civil to you? I might as well be hanged for a sheep as a lamb.
You have no right to assume that the court has made up its mind without a fair trial. And you will please not address me as General. I am Major Swindon.
Oh, 1,000 pardons. I thought I had the honour of addressing Gentlemanly Johnny.
I believe I am Gentlemanly Johnny, sir, at your service. My more intimate friends call me General Burgoyne. You will understand, sir, I hope, since you seem to be a gentleman and a man of some spirit, in spite of your calling, that if we should have the misfortune to hang you, we shall do so as a mere matter of political necessity and military duty, without any personal ill feeling.
Oh, quite so. That makes all the difference in the world, of course.
How can you?
You promised to be silent.
Believe me, madam, your husband is placing us under the greatest obligation by taking this very disagreeable business so thoroughly in the spirit of a gentleman. Sergeant, give Mr. Anderson a chair. Ah, Major Swindon, we are waiting for you.
You are aware, I presume, Mr. Anderson, of your obligations as a subject of His Majesty King George III.
I'm aware, sir, that His Majesty King George III is about to hang me because I object to Lord North's robbing me.
That is a treasonable speech, sir.
Yes, I meant it to be.
How dare you?
Don't you think, Mr. Anderson, that this is rather, if you will excuse the word, a vulgar line to take? Why should you cry out robbery because of a stamp duty and a tea duty and so forth? After all, it is the essence of your position as a gentleman that you pay with a good grace.
Oh, it's not the money, General. But to be swindled by a pig-headed lunatic like King George III...
Ah, that is another point of view. My position does not allow my going into that, except in private.
But, of course, Mr. Anderson, if you are determined to be hanged, there's nothing more to be said. An unusual taste. However...
Shall we call witnesses, sir?
What need is there of witnesses? If the townspeople here had listened to me, you would have found the streets barricaded, the houses loopholed, and the people in arms to hold the town against you to the last man. And you arrived, unfortunately, before we'd got out of the talking stage. And then it was too late.
Well, sir, we shall teach you and your townspeople a lesson they will not forget. Have you anything more to say?
I think you might have the decency to treat me as a prisoner of war and shoot me like a man instead of hanging me like a dog.
Ah, now there, Mr. Anderson, you talk like a civilian, if you will excuse my saying so. Have you any idea of the average marksmanship of the army of His Majesty King George III? If we make you up a firing party, what will happen? Half of them will miss you. The rest will make a mess of the business and leave you to the Provost Marshal's pistol, whereas we can hang you in a perfectly workmanlike and agreeable way. Let me persuade you to be hanged, Mr. Anderson.
God!
Your promise, madam. Thank you, General. That view of the case did not occur to me before. To oblige you, I withdraw my objection to the rope. Hang me by all means.
Will 12 o'clock suit you, Mr. Anderson?
I shall be at your disposal then, General.
Nothing more to be said, gentlemen.
You are not going to murder a man like that without a proper trial, without thinking of what you're doing, without...
Is this how you keep your promise?
If I am not to speak, you must. Defend yourself. Save yourself. Tell them the truth.
I have told them truth enough to hang me 10 times over. If you say another word, you will risk other lives, but you will not save mine.
My good lady, our only desire is to save unpleasantness. What satisfaction would it give you to have a solemn fuss made with my friend Swindon in a black cap and so forth? I'm sure we are greatly indebted to the admirable tact and gentlemanly feeling shown by your husband.
Oh, you're mad! Is it nothing to you what wicked thing you do if only you do it like a gentleman? Is it nothing to you whether you are a murderer or not if only you murder in a red coat? You shall not hang him. That man is not my husband.
I appeal to you, gentlemen, to put an end to this. She will not believe that she cannot save me. Break up the court.
One moment, Mr. Anderson. One moment, gentlemen. Let me understand you clearly, madam. Do you mean that this gentleman is not your husband, or merely, I wish to put this with all delicacy, that you are not his wife?
I don't know what you mean. I say that he is not my husband, that my husband has escaped. This man took his place to save him. Ask anyone in the town. Send out into the street for the first person you find there and bring him in as a witness. He'll tell you that the prisoner is not Anthony Anderson.
Sergeant?
Sir?
Go out into the street and bring in the first townsman you see there.
Yes, sir.
The first clean, sober townsman you see.
Yes, sir.
Sit down, Mr. Anderson, if I may call you so for the present. Sit down, madam, whilst we wait. Give the lady a newspaper.
Oh, shame!
If you are not her husband, sir, the case is not a serious one for her.
I couldn't help it.
You will understand, of course, Mr. Anderson, that you must not build on this little incident. We are bound to make an example of somebody.
Oh, I quite understand. I suppose there is no use in my explaining.
I think we should prefer independent testimony, if you don't mind.
The sergeant, with a packet of papers in his hand, returns. He also brings with him the independent testimony, who is none other than Christy Dudgeon, who is much scared.
This way. In here. Dispatches, sir. Delivered by a corporal of the 33rd. Dead beat with hard riding, sir. Come on now, then. Attention! Take your hat off.
Don't be frightened, you fool. You're only wanted as a witness. They're not going to hang you.
What's your name?
Christy.
Christopher Dudgeon, you blatant idiot. Give your full name.
Be silent, prisoner. You must not prompt the witness.
Oh, very well, but I warn you, you'll get nothing out of him unless you shake it out of him. He's been too well brought up by a pious mother to have any sense of manhood left in him.
Where is the man who brought these dispatches?
In the guard room, sir.
I must see him at once.
Do you know Anthony Anderson, the Presbyterian minister?
Of course I do.
Is he here?
I don't know.
Do you see him?
No.
You seem to know the prisoner.
Do you mean Dick?
Which is Dick?
Him.
What is his name?
Dick.
Answer properly, you jumping jackass. What do they know about Dick?
Well, you are Dick, ain't you? What am I to say?
Address me, sir. And do you, prisoner, be silent. Tell us who the prisoner is.
He's my brother, Dick. Richard Dudgeon.
Your brother?
Yes.
You are sure he is not Anderson?
Who?
Oh, me.
Silence, sir!
Silence! Oh,
he wants to know, am I Minister Anderson? Tell him. And stop grinning like a zany.
You, Pastor Anderson? Well, Mr. Anderson's a minister, very good man. Dick's a bad character. The respectable people won't speak to him. He's the bad brother. I'm the good one.
Who arrested this man?
I did, sir. Mm. I found him in the minister's house, sitting at tea with a lady, with his coat off, quite at home. If he isn't married to her, he ought to be.
Did he answer to the minister's name?
Yes, sir. But not to a minister's nature. You asked the chaplain, sir.
So, sir, you have attempted to cheat us, and your name is Richard Dudgeon.
You found it out at last, have you?
Dudgeon is a name well known to us.
Oh, yes. Peter Dudgeon, whom you murdered, was my uncle.
Ah. Are they going to hang you, Dick?
Yes. Now get out. They've done with you.
How do I keep the china peacocks?
Oh, get out, you blithering baboon, you!
Since you have taken the minister's place, Richard Dudgeon, you shall go through with it. The execution will take place at 12 o'clock as arranged, and unless Anderson surrenders before then, you shall take his place on the gallows. Sergeant, take your man out.
No!
Take the woman away,
you infernal scoundrel!
What is this? What's happening? Mr. Anderson, I'm astonished at you.
I am sorry I disturbed you, General. I merely wanted to strangle your understrapper there.
Understrapper?
Why do you raise the devil in me by bullying a woman like that, you oatmeal-faced dog? I twist your cursed head off with the greatest satisfaction. Here, Sergeant, handcuff me, will you? Or I will not undertake to keep my fingers off him.
Have you addressed profane language to the lady, Major Swindon?
No, sir, certainly not. That question should not have been put to me. I ordered the woman to be removed, as she was disorderly. And a fellow sprang at me. Oh, put away those handcuffs, Sergeant. I am perfectly able to take care of myself.
Now you talk like a man. I have no quarrel with you.
Mr. Anderson...
His name is Dudgeon, sir. Richard Dudgeon. He is an impostor.
Nonsense, sir. You hanged Dudgeon at Springtown.
It was my uncle, General.
Oh, your uncle?
Yes.
I beg your pardon, Major Swindon.
Sir.
We are somewhat unfortunate in our relations with your families. Well, Mr. Dudgeon, what I wanted to ask you is this. Who is William Maindeck Parshotter?
He's the mayor of Springtown.
Is William Maindeck and so on a man of his word?
Is he selling you anything?
No.
Then you may depend on him.
Thank you, Mr. Dudgeon. By the way, since you are not Mr. Anderson, do we still, Major Swindon?
The arrangements are unaltered, General.
Ah, indeed. I am sorry. Good morning, Mr. Dudgeon.
General.
Good morning, madam.
How can
not
you...
Not one word more. Come.
Come along, you. You disappoint me.
Gentlemen, we need not detain you.
No, madam.
Major Swindon, a word with you. Swindon, do you know what this is?
What?
A demand for a safe conduct for an officer of their militia to come here and arrange terms with us.
Oh, they're giving in.
They add that they are sending the man who raised Springtown last night and drove us out so that we may know that we're dealing with an officer of importance. He will be fully empowered to arrange the terms of, guess what?
Their surrender, I hope.
No. Our evacuation of the town. They offer us just 6 hours to clear out.
What? What monstrous impudence.
What shall we do, eh?
March on Springtown and strike a decisive blow at once.
Come to the adjutant's office.
What for?
To write out that safe conduct.
General Burgoyne.
Sir?
It is my duty to tell you, sir, that I do not consider the threats of a mob of rebellious tradesmen a sufficient reason for our giving way.
Suppose I resign my command to you. What will you do?
I will undertake to do what we have marched south from Quebec to do, and what General Howe has marched north from New York to do. Effect a junction at Albany and wipe out the rebel army with our united forces.
And will you wipe out our enemies in London, too?
London? What enemies?
Jobbery and snobbery, incompetence and red tape. I have just learned, sir, that General Howe is still in New York.
Good God! He has disobeyed orders.
He has received no orders, sir. Some gentleman in London forgot to dispatch them. He was leaving town for his holiday, I believe. To avoid upsetting his arrangements, England will lose her American colonies, and in a few days you and I will be at Saratoga with 5,000 men to face 18,000 rebels in an impregnable position.
Impossible.
I beg your pardon?
I can't believe it. What will history say?
History, sir, will tell lies, as usual. Come, we must send the safe conduct.
My God, we shall be wiped out.
As noon approaches, there is excitement in the marketplace. The Webster Bridge townsfolk are present in force and in high spirits. For the news has spread that it is the devil's disciple and not the minister that King George and his terrible general are about to hang. Consequently, the execution can be enjoyed without any misgivings as to its righteousness or to the cowardice of allowing it to take place without a struggle. There is even some fear of a disappointment as midday approaches, and the arrival of the beadle with the ladder remains the only sign of preparation. But at last, reassuring shouts of, "Here they come! Here they are!" are heard, and a company of soldiers with fixed bayonets, half British infantry, half Hessians, tramp quickly into the middle of the marketplace.
Hey! I dress!
Out of it! Out of it with you! Out of it! Some of you get strung up yourselves presently. Now form that square there, will you, you damned Hoosians? It's no use talking German to them. Talk to their toes of the butt ends of your muskets, they'll understand that. Now get out of it, will you? Now then, ma'am, you've no call here.
May I not stay? What harm am I doing?
I want none of your argufying. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, running to see a man hanged that's not your husband. And he's no better than yourself. I told my major he was a gentleman, and then he goes and tries to strangle him and calls his blessed majesty a lunatic. So out of it with you, double quick.
Will you take these two silver dollars and let me stay?
Oh, thank you, ma'am. What, me take money in the execution of a duty? Certainly not. I'll tell you what I'll do to teach you to corrupt the king's officer. I'll put you under arrest until the execution's over. You just stand there and don't let me see you as much as move from that spot until you're let.
Thank you.
Now then, dress up and keep them back, will you?
Cries of hush and silence are heard among the townsfolk, and the sound of a military band playing the Dead March from Saul is heard. The crowd becomes quiet at once. First come Burgoyne and Swindon, then Mr. Brudenell, the chaplain, in his surplice, with his prayer book open in his hand, walking beside Richard, who is moody and disorderly. Behind him comes the executioner, a stalwart soldier in his shirt sleeves. Following him, two soldiers haul a light military wagon. Finally comes the band, which posts itself at the back of the square and finishes the Dead March. Judith, watching Richard painfully, steals down to the gallows and stands leaning against its right post.
Look here, Chaplain, this is no place for a man of your profession. Hadn't you better go away?
I appeal to you, prisoner, if you have any sense of decency left, to listen to the ministrations of the chaplain and pay due heed to the solemnity of the occasion.
Try to control yourself and submit to the divine will.
You answer for your own will, sir, and those of your accomplices here. I see little divinity about them or you. You talk to me of Christianity when you're in the act of hanging your enemies. Was there ever such blasphemous nonsense?
Blasphemous.
You've got up the solemnity of the occasion, as you call it, to impress the people with your own dignity. Handel's music and a clergyman to make murder look like piety. But just suppose I'm going to help you. You asked me to choose the rope because you don't know your own trade well enough to shoot me properly. Well, hang away and have done with it.
Can you do nothing with him, Mr. Brudenell?
I will try, sir. Man that is born of woman.
Thou shalt not kill.
What am I to say, Mr. Dutch?
Let me alone, man, can't you?
I think, Mr. Brudenell, that as the usual professional observations seem to strike Mr. Dudgeon as an incongruous under the circumstances, you had better omit them until Mr. Dudgeon can no longer be inconvenienced by them.
Very well.
You seem in a hurry, Mr. Dudgeon.
Do you think this is a pleasant sort of thing to be kept waiting for, You've made up your mind to commit murder? Well, do it and have done with it.
Mr. Dudgeon, we are only doing this...
Because you are paid to do it.
I'm really sorry that you should think that, Mr. Dudgeon. If you knew what my commission cost me and what my pay is, you would think better of me. I should be glad to part from you on friendly terms.
Harkee, General Burgoyne. If you think that I like being hanged, you're mistaken. I don't like it, and I don't mean to pretend that I do. And if you think I'm obliged to you for hanging me in a gentlemanly way, you're wrong there, too. I take the whole business in a devilish bad part. And the only satisfaction I have in it is that you'll feel a good deal meaner than I'll look when it's over.
Richard, weren't you...
What are you doing here? This is no place for you. Go away. You'll unnerve me. Take her away, will you?
Won't you bid me goodbye?
Goodbye. Now go quickly.
Oh, Richard!
Sergeant! How is this? Why is she inside the lines?
Well, I don't know, sir. She's that artful. You can't keep her away.
You were bribed.
Oh, no, sir.
Fall back.
Yes, sir.
Take her away. Do you think I want a woman near me now?
Here, madam. You had better keep inside the lines. But stand here behind us. And don't look.
No, I must stay. I won't look. Oh, our Father, which art in heaven.
Ah, quite so. Pray. Do not disturb her, Mr. Brudenell. That will do very nicely. Now then, are those preparations made? We must not detain Mr. Dudgeon. Have you anything more to say, Mr. Dudgeon? It wants 12:02 still.
Your watch is 2 minutes slow by the town clock, which I can see from up here, General. Amen. My life for the world's future.
Amen. And stop the execution. Sir, I am Anthony Anderson, the man you want.
Indeed. Then you are just in time to take your place on the gallows. Arrest him.
There's my safe conduct, sir.
Safe conduct? Are you...
I am. Tell these men to take their hands off me.
Oh, let him go.
Fall back, you two.
Oh, thank God I was in time.
Ample time, sir. Plenty of time. I should never dream of hanging any gentleman by an American clock.
Yes, we are some minutes ahead of you already, General. Now, tell them to take the rope from the neck of that American citizen.
Kindly undo, Mr. Dudgeon.
Tony.
Well... What do you think of your husband now, eh? Eh? Eh?
I'm ashamed.
You look disappointed, Major Swindon.
You look defeated, General Burgoyne.
I am, sir, and I am humane enough to be glad of it.
Mr. Anderson.
By the way, Mr. Anderson, I do not quite understand. The safe conduct was for a commander of the militia. I understand that you are a clergyman.
Sir... It is in the hour of trial that a man finds his true profession. This foolish young man boasted himself the devil's disciple. But when the hour of trial came to him, he found that it was his destiny to suffer and be faithful to the death. I thought myself a decent minister of the gospel of peace. But when the hour of trial came to me, I found that it was my destiny to be a man of action, and that my place was amid the thunder of the captains and the shouting. So I am starting life at 50 as Captain Anthony Anderson of the Springtown Militia, and the devil's disciple here will start presently as the Reverend Richard Dudgeon and wag his pow in my old pulpit and give good advice to this silly, sentimental little wife of mine. Your mother told me, Richard, that I should never have chosen Judith if I'd been born for the ministry. I'm afraid she was right. So, by your leave, you may keep my coat and I'll keep yours.
Minister, I should say, Captain, I have behaved like a fool.
Like a hero.
Much the same thing, perhaps. But no, if I'd been any good, I should have done for you what you did for me, instead of making a vain sacrifice.
Not vain, my boy. It takes all sorts to make a world, saints as well as soldiers. And now, General, time presses and America is in a hurry. Have you realized that though you may occupy towns and win battles, you cannot conquer a nation?
My good sir, without a conquest, you cannot have an aristocracy. Come and settle the matter at my headquarters.
At your service, sir. See Judith home for me, will you, my boy? Now, General.
Oh, by the way, Mr. Dudgeon, I shall be glad to see you at lunch at 1:30. Bring Mrs. Anderson, if she will be so good. Take it quietly, Major Swindon. Your friend, the British soldier, can stand up to anything except the British War Office.
What orders, sir?
Orders? What use are orders now? There's no army. Back to quarters and be damned.
Smoke! Control! Carrying. Holding the muskets. All fours. Right wheel, quick march.
Oh, Dick!
Now, now, oh, Essie, Dick. Calm, come on. I don't mind being hanged, but I will not be cried over.
No, I promise I'll be good. I want to see where the soldiers are going to. Promise me you will never tell him.
Don't be afraid. Shake hands on it.
They're coming back. They want you.
The Devil's Disciple by Bernard Shaw. With James Laurenson as Richard Dudgeon, Tony Church as General Burgoyne, Lucy Fleming as Judith Anderson, and Tenniel Evans as Anthony Anderson. Others in the cast were Mrs. Dudgeon, Constance Chapman, Christy Dudgeon, Terence Wilton, Major Swindon, Hayden Jones, Lawyer Hawkins, Michael Rothwell, Essie, Eva Haddon, the Sergeant, Trevor Martin, Uncle William, Dennis Bowen, Uncle Titus, Esmond Rideout, and Mr. Broodnell, Timothy Keitley. The narrator was Dennis Hawthorne. The programme, which came from Bristol, was produced and directed by Brian Miller.
Well, next week, with a puff of powder and a few strategically placed patches, we'll be transporting you back to Britain in the days of the Prince Regent, when a beautiful young heiress, Judith Taverner, begins a dangerous and romantic adventure in high society London. Adapted from the novel by Georgette Heyer, Regency Buck is our feature-length drama next week, same time. Now, it may be the height of summer, but for the next few weeks here on 4 Extra, Sunday evenings are going to be dark as we bring you a series of disturbing stories with a gothic air. The first tale from the pen of Robert Louis Stevenson is A Supernatural Affair, read by Hugh Bonneville.
A flash of ice, a flash of fire, a bursting gush of blood went over him, and then he stood transfixed and thrilling. A step mounted the stair slowly and steadily, and presently a hand was laid upon the knob and the lock clicked and the door opened. Fear held Markheim in a vice.
A Short History of Gothic begins with Markheim by Robert Louis Stevenson, all part of the Seventh Dimension, tomorrow night at 6 and midnight.
My job as a counsellor is just to listen, and if I can, to give you a bit of advice.
A year or two ago, my partner and I set up a business, government media relations. We were broke, debt collectors everywhere, but it was a hell of a lot of fun.
So what's gone wrong?
Well, we've become successful, appallingly successful.
John Bird and Stephen Fry.
5 days a week I listen to fat, overpaid, middle-aged men whinging on. Why don't you just go away, you boring, overpaid pillock? You wouldn't have time for a midlife crisis if you were doing night shifts in a biscuit factory.
Absolute Power on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Oh, yes, thank you. Thank you. Same time next week.
Monday nights in the Comedy Club at 10:30.
The digital station for comedy, drama and entertainment. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Well, now, in a programme first broadcast back in 2004, Linda Bellingham can-canned on stage with hardly a stitch on, while dancer Tudor Davis remembers Twang, the show with not one, but two exclamation marks in the title. It's Curtain Up on some fabulous flops.
Hello, I'm Paul Roseby, and welcome to the programme that salutes, celebrates, and if I'm feeling particularly self-centred, commiserates the most momentous disasters of the British musical theatre. You may already sense a tease of a smile itching to grow into my full-blown grin on my somewhat flexy face as I embark on a dark, dangerous journey to discover all that is wonderful and often so wonderless about one of the dirtiest phrases in entertainment. Putting on a musical. So, why the smile? Well, of course I'm smiling. We British love a flop. We do them so well. And I might add, there are so many to choose from. Although, who was it that once said, it's rude to count? No one. So we've done just that. Since the 1960s, there have been nearly 300 musicals in the West End. Only 15 survived longer than a year. The remainder danced their way to closure before you could get your drink at the Interval Bar. Mind you, the time it takes you to get your drink at the Interval Bar, it's not surprising. While researching this series over a few drinks, and on a quest for theatrical horror stories for your entertainment, I wondered whether I was nothing more than a sad and twisted individual wrongfully wringing my hands in satisfaction at having uncovered another fabulous flop. And then I got over it. I mean, if I am those things, I know I'm not alone. There's a lot of us out there. Flop-watching is surely one of the best observational sports there is. And to make sure I'm not alone, I spoke to the writer, performer Kit Hesketh-Harvey.
I think the point about musicals is that they are a fabulously artificial form to tell a story. When they work, like opera, they are magnificent and tell a story better than anything. But there's an awful lot of ifs in that. And when they crash, because the stakes are so high, there is huge fun to be had from that. On any first night, half the audience is willing the thing to fail. I mean, it's not like going to a straight play. People adore watching an enormous road smash. And when that happens, oh, the glee.
Oh, yes, much glee to be had. Michael Billington, for one, can't wait.
One doesn't want, really, to spend one's life as a critic licking one's lips over accidents and disasters. One would rather celebrate triumphs. But I mean, watching flops is a bit like ambulance chasing. You are, in fact, sort of going to the scene of the crime, and after a time I think it becomes a rather distasteful sport.
Now, before I spill and kill, I grappled not just with my conscience, but as to whether we should include some American theatrical disasters too, who are not amiss to the odd Broadway boo-boo themselves. Yes, even in failure, sadly, we Brits cannot stand alone. For instance, the latest flop, Dances with Vampires, starring Michael Crawford, bled to death just after 2 months. But the flop phenomenon in Britain is much more exciting, simply because we are a more difficult audience to predict. A man who has stood the test of time and show business is one of our most successful lyricists for 35 years, Don Black. And he was on Broadway when I asked him about the difference between us and them. He was on Broadway. I, on the other hand, was on the other end of the phone. I'm not bitter.
A lot of them would be very much at home in the forensic department for some medical school, because they do dissect musicals. You know, you can hear them coming out of the producers or Hairspray and saying, well, they should have developed that character more, or you didn't see much of that one. I think in England, they either like it or they don't.
This series is about the ones they being you, the great British paying public, did not like. So here we go. No name, no star turn, no subject will deem too sensitive as we go in the search of the most fabulous of flops. The bombing of Nagasaki, the raping of peasants, the hunting of witches, and the problems of premature ejaculation have all been subjects deemed worthy of a show tune, and all have flopped without trace. Until now. As a friend of mine in LA says, putting on a show is easy, keeping it on is the skill. And as another friend of mine in LA said, I love your shoes, are they Gucci? So, with my Gucci's firmly under the table, and with so many flops to choose from, I'm in the luxurious position of attaching a little theme to our four episodes. The first, I wish to dedicate to the dancer, affectionately known as the twirler, the West End Wendy, the unsung heroes of West End shows, that unique breed of being that lives on adrenaline and thin air, and to whom the manufacturers of leg warmers will be eternally grateful. So, with a dancer's count of 5, 6, 7, 8, let's do a backward flip to our first flop. It's the 1970s. Everything is long. Skirts, hair, Bjorn Borg. But the musical Bordello at the Queen's Theatre, Shaftesbury Avenue in 1976...